Welcome to That's History, our regular segment that looks at current events and finds echoes and parallels in the past. I'm Chris Satula, and I'm joined, as always, by Jonathan Zimmerman, professor of history at New York University. Welcome, Jonathan.
Good to be here, as always.
Okay, it's kind of a cold day here in Philadelphia, but we're going to cast our eyes to sunny Arizona in the desert and something that happened at the end of the last month, February, when the governor, Jan Brewer, vetoed a bill.
Yeah, Governor Brewer vetoed a bill that would have allowed businesses to reject or turn away patrons if serving them violated the proprietor's, quote, sincere religious belief. And although this measure didn't reference gays or homosexuals directly, everybody understood, based on events that had happened in New Mexico and elsewhere, that that was the purpose of the bill, again, to allow proprietors, if they wished, to reject a patron if they believed the patron was gay.
Yeah, it was framed, I believe the title of the bill was something about protecting the free exercise of religion.
Yes.
But to some surprise, Governor Brewer rejected it, vetoed it with pretty strong language, saying that it was not in the best interests of Arizona. Why did she feel in the end that it wasn't in the best interest?
Well, she felt it wasn't in the best interest because really every powerful business interest in the state of Arizona aligned against it. The Chamber of Commerce and big employers like J.P. Morgan, everyone involved in getting the Super Bowl to Arizona, all of them with almost a unified voice said that this would be a disaster for the economy of the state of Arizona.
Yeah, I believe the NFL basically sent a warning shot that if the bill turned into law, they might have to reconsider holding the Super Bowl in Phoenix.
And that would have meant an estimated loss of maybe $500 million for the state when it's all added up.
Right. So this cast your mind going back through history to some lunch counters at Woolworth's in the South.
Indeed. The famous sit-in movement beginning in 1960 in Greensboro, North Carolina, and culminating in 1964 with the Civil Rights Act that, of course, barred businesses from discriminating on the basis of race. Mm-hmm. What happened in between and what got me thinking about this precedent was an enormous switch in the white business community on this question. When the sit-in movement started, most white businesses said, we can't desegregate. Sometimes they invoked freedom of association, which is another term you heard a little bit in Arizona. It's our right to associate with whom we'd like. But most of the time, they invoked dollars and cents. The argument was, these are white-majority communities, and if we desegregate a lunch counter, we will lose the business of the majority, which are white people, and we can't do that.
So really, they were more worried about the economic factor than any sort of social factor. As if they let African-Americans sit, the white clientele would walk.
Exactly. And if it became a so-called black business, that is, if it became known as a business that was patronized by blacks, that white patrons wouldn't go there.
And then how did this economic factor play out?
Well, it just turned out that in that economic calculation, leaving aside all moral questions that this would be bad for business, that the white-owned businesses were simply wrong. They assumed that if you desegregated, white patrons wouldn't go there. But what happened was a couple places did desegregate. Whites continued to patronize. More to the point, the places that didn't desegregate, they were boycotted, obviously, by the sit-in movement. And they lost business, both black and white. And a lot of commentators, as early 1961, start to say, you know, hey, if we don't desegregate, we're going to lose both races to these new enterprises out in the suburbs called shopping malls.
Right. So that's a point you make in your essay about this topic that appears on newsworks.org. But you have a parallel trend here, and they're interwoven a bit. The notion of white flight to the suburbs had something to do with the migration, in-migration of African-Americans to the centers of cities. But basically, if you were an urban businessman, if part of your clientele was fleeing to the outer reaches, jumping on the interstates, the clientele that remained was likely to be African-American, and you couldn't afford not to serve them.
Definitely. I mean, I think it is important to note in most southern cities, the era we're talking about right now, the early 1960s, is really before the great era of white flight, which mm-hmm. comes in the late 60s and especially the 1970s. Mm-hmm. There are some whites moving to the suburbs, but most of them are still closer to the inner, what today we'd call the inner city. And they were the majority. Woolworths, et cetera, are correct when they say they need the majority to patronize them. They were simply incorrect in the assumption that this majority wouldn't patronize them if they serve both blacks and whites.
Now, there was a sense, heading back to the current day and the Arizona bill that Governor Brewer vetoed, that some proponents of gay rights, people who are delighted with the way things seem to be trending in our society, were still unhappy with her in the sense that she framed it largely as a matter of the self-interest of Arizona, not as a matter of rights. Jonathan, you think that might be a little short-sighted on their part?
Well, I think it's just ahistorical. I mean, yeah. Debbie Wasserman Schultz, the DNC leader, made a similar comment, said something like, you know, Governor Brewer's veto was not exactly a profile in courage because in her message she emphasized the economic consequences of discrimination. I think that's ahistorical in the sense that the economic consequences were always at the heart of the anti-discrimination movement, and they were probably the key factor in creating the headwinds for the Civil Rights Act. You know, by 62 and 63, you have the likes of Woolworths actually lobbying for that act because they were afraid that if that act didn't pass, they might get in certain places undercut by white-only businesses. So the same enterprises that were in 1960, resisting desegregation, actually started supporting that law, again, for I think what could fairly be called economic reasons.
That's Jonathan Zimmerman, professor of history at New York University, working as always to tease out the lessons of history and connect them to the events of the present day. Thank you, Jonathan.
Thanks. It was fun.